Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. We have a lot to talk about. This is the Monday after the Mueller report. Who better to talk with about that than Benjamin Wittes, who is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare Blog. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me. You guys have been crushing it.
Well, thank you. You know, over the weekend, you were doing something very interesting. You were doing what you called a reading diary, notes on the Mueller report. And I have to tell you, it was it's heavy. It's a heavy slog for some of us to dive into a 448-page document. So your notes were really quite helpful. Just so tell me what a reading diary is and why you decided to do it that way.
Well, I don't know what a read. I guess I'm making it up as I go along. But I you know, when the report came out Thursday, my first job was to figure out, you know, what a kind of first day overview from Lawfare looked like. And, you know, we had a whole team that worked on that. But kind of my job was to sort of have 360 visibility of the report. But the result was that as of Thursday, I had read sections of it pretty carefully, and I'd kind of read in all the sections of it. But I kind of feel a duty to Lawfare readers and to myself, frankly, to start at the first page and read through the end and figure out, you know, everything that I have to say about this document section by section. So Friday morning, I started doing that. And as I, you know, was thinking about how do you write about this, because it's so much information, it's so much legal analysis, and it's and the altitude of it varies from the sort of really high altitude, big picture stuff, like did the president obstruct justice, right, to these very granular, detailed factual and legal points. And so I sort of just threw up my hands and said, I don't know how to do this in any kind of cohesive way. So I'm just going to take notes on every single section. And when I get to the end of every single section, I'm just going to write up my thoughts. And I'm not going to try to have an overarching thesis. I'm just going to do it as a kind of almost like a reading journal. And so I started doing that on Friday, and I have done it sort of all the way through the weekend. And I'm now halfway done. I've read and commented on volume one of the report, and I'm now ready to turn to volume two. And so if you want a, I don't know, 420 page and four, instead of 448 page or however long the report is, commentary on the report, you can read my, I'm joking, it's significantly shorter than the report. But it's a, you know, it's the report as seen through the lens of my reading of it.
You know, I had this the thought over the weekend as I was reading through it, that this was the book that so many of the other insider accounts, you know, wanted to be. And I think Carlos Lozada of the Washington Post said, you know, this is the best book just as a read to come out of the Trump presidency. I mean, it's certainly a lot better and more reliable than Fire and Fury, even Bob Woodward's book. But also, it really strikes me that the verdict of history is starting to come into focus. We never know how our times will be remembered. We live it in real time, but this will be the essential document for any historian writing about the Trump administration. I mean, it is going to have incredible value for historians trying to figure out what happened, what were the facts, what was the personality, what was that granular feel of inside the White House?
Right, and I think, you know, one of the things that will make it so authoritative is that it's so narrow, right? It is not a general portrait, as, for example, Woodward's book is, right, of decision-making in the Trump presidency, right? It is not a, you know, there's no discussion of pulling letters withdrawing from trade agreements off of the president's desk, or how the president, you know, explodes with rage about X matter or Y matter. It is simply a portrait, at least the part of it that deals with the presidency as opposed to the campaign, is simply a portrait of the manner in which the president engaged the law enforcement instruments that were investigating him. And, you know, I have argued, and you and I have talked about this for 2 years now, that is the essential danger and innovation of Donald Trump, right? Which is that he does not, that he has a vision of the relationship between the president and law enforcement that is deeply, deeply aberrational with respect to the entire modern traditions of the country. And this is a deep dive on that. And if you believe, as I do, that that is the molten core of the Trump presidency, I mean, it is literally 7 days after he takes office that he demands a loyalty oath from his FBI director. And if you believe that that's the essence, the core of the Trump presidency is defined by this warped idea of how you can and can't use the law enforcement apparatus of the country, this is like the X-ray that gets to the soul.
You have an interesting point here. You say that people are going to see in this history what they want to see, which, of course, is the world we live in, these alternative realities. If you want to see vindication for Trump in the absence of evidence of a criminal conspiracy, readily available for those looking for collusion in a more colloquial sense of the word, plenty of grist for that conclusion, you know, between Trump Tower Moscow, the Trump Tower meeting, bizarre behavior of Papadopoulos, Manafort and Page, the almost endless back channel communications during the transition. And for people looking, thinking in a counterintelligence framework, target-rich environment on that front as well. So let's dive into this part. I focused from the beginning on the question of obstruction of justice, which I think is the most damaging long-term for Trump. But let's talk about this, the evidence of the links or the contacts or contacts, as you point out, not all that close to establishing coordination in the sense that the conspiracy law would recognize. But you write, the volume of contacts, the lies and the open questions make it impossible to say there's no evidence of it, much less that there's positive evidence falsifying it. So what do you see? You've gone through, you know, hundreds of pages of material. You know, we've gotten caught up in the words like collusion and conspiracy and coordination. So what did you see? What is the distilled version of the story that Mueller tells?
Hang on, I'm going to cough.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
So I think there's two major themes, and I want to disaggregate them. The first is on Trump campaign engagement with the hacking and release of the information, which is dealt with in the Mueller report in, I believe, Section 3, which is on the hacking and dissemination campaign. And here, I think the actual claims of vindication by the Trump people are almost farcical, because I read that section as astonishingly damning. And to me, it begins and ends with three facts. The first is that the president, you know, after giving this speech where he said, Russia, if you're listening, can you find Hillary Clinton's email, orders Mike Flynn repeatedly to go find the missing emails. So, you know, the effort the White House has made to say, well, this was just a joke, is actually turns out to be nonsense. The president actually had a conspiracy theory that a lot of people shared, that, you know, there were these 30,000 missing emails that the Russians had retrieved, and he dispatches his campaign national security advisor, who later becomes his White House national security advisor, to try to recover them. And Flynn tries to do this by engaging with outside people who actually go out and try to meet with or find what they believe to be Russian hackers who've stolen these emails. Now, there's no reason to think they found actual Russian hackers, much less that there were real emails. But this is the moral level at which, according to the Mueller report, the president was engaging the hacking story. He was engaging it of, great, they're hacking her, maybe they can find the emails I want. And, you know, so to me, the only reason this isn't a crime, by the way, is that it was a fantasy. So it's not a crime to go after, to try to deal with fake hackers to get stolen emails that actually don't exist. But I do think that the idea that they were innocent of being involved in the Russian hacking operation is mischievous. They were innocent of being involved in the real Russian right. hacking operation. They were deeply involved in trying to engage with a fictitious one. The second area, which is, I think, the question, what you were thinking of when you asked the question, is how should we understand this astonishing group, a sequence of meetings and between and links and contacts between Trump campaign figures and people connected with Russia.
I actually lost count of the number of contacts and meetings. It is extraordinary.
It's an extraordinary sequence, and it goes on. It's literally more than 100 pages of text, and some of them turn out to be pretty innocent. A lot of them do not, and none of them amounts to conspiracy, Mueller finds, and I actually agree with that. I don't think it's a particularly close question, except on the campaign finance side. But I did walk away from it saying it is, you know, if it's not conspiracy, if it's not collusion, if it's not coordination, it is nonetheless a very deep betrayal of the country. And I guess the reason I came to that judgment was that these is a group of people, and what really comes off the page when you read them is that this is a group of people who were so overwhelmed by partisan political polarization. They were so convinced that Hillary Clinton was the enemy, that they were willing to do business with, engage, and see as an ally an actual enemy of the United States, which is to say Vladimir Putin, at a time that they knew him to be conducting a federal system in which they were then participating. And so I don't want to say it's illegal. I fully accept Bob Mueller's prosecutorial judgment. I actually more than accept it. I agree with it. And yet I don't think you can read that 100 pages and come away with a sense, as Rudy Giuliani suggested, that they've been cleared. I think they've been branded as having engaged in a massive failure of patriotism.
Yeah, no, this was clarifying, because you know you walk through, you know, all of the evidence, he's willing to do business and seek favors from the Russian state as it was attacking us. You know, the senior leadership of the campaign right from the top obviously knew about their efforts, were eager to benefit from Russia's efforts to dish dirt. Multiple campaign staffers engaged in conduct in relation to an actual enemy that actually gave rise to counterintelligence investigation. And then they lied over and over and over again to investigators about their dealings with the Russians, which is amazing. So if you don't want to call it collusion or conspiracy or coordination, it is betrayal. But also, you know, as you describe it, this is the logical outgrowth of this Flight 93 election type thing, that the fate of the country depends on winning this election. The other side is so evil, it is so malign, that any tactic is all right. And I do think that this is kind of a little will shine a light to historians about how extreme. It's not just that we were polarized, it's the way in which we were willing to embrace extraordinary tactics and willing to destroy so many norms because it was so crucial for us to win, and or even more important, that the other side would lose.
Yeah, so I agree with that completely. I also think there is an element of Trump's individual personality here. So, you know, it is one thing to be in a highly polarized environment and believe you're in a Flight 93 election scenario, and yet still to look in the camera over and over and over again and say, I have nothing to do with Russia. I have no deals there. When you know that you are currently negotiating to build a giant building in the middle of Moscow, and you're asking a help from the president of Russia to do that, requires a certain, I don't know, sort of narcissistic nihilism that I think is probably a separate axis from the polarization axis. But I agree with you. They very deeply at some level believed that no tactic was off limits. And they didn't, you know, one thing that you don't see in that 100 pages is anybody saying, gosh, we shouldn't, you know, we could do this, but it would be wrong.
Maybe we should tell someone.
Maybe we should, but even before, like, we should tell the FBI, no one ever stops in the, as the Trump Tower meeting. The closest actually is Paul Manafort, of all people, who says, you know, we should be careful with this. But it's not a moral objection. It's a kind of like, hey, this could blow back and could look bad. You know, no one ever stops in this 100 pages and says, is this the way a patriot would act?
Yeah, that is the failure of patriotism. By the way, just sort of parenthetically before we move on, I noted, like, on the first page of one of your reading diaries, you wrote, sorry, Devin Nunes, there's no mention of the Steele dossier. After all of the obsession on both sides about the Steele dossier and the continuing ongoing obsession about the Steele dossier, not a single mention in the entire Mueller report. That's also remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so I was amused by that reference early in the report to the origins of the Russia investigation, and the description is almost casual. It's, by the way, the investigation started when a foreign intelligence service shared that George Papadopoulos had made these remarks about, you know, having been told that the Russians had dirt on Hillary. And, you know, this is exactly what the FBI has been saying for a long time now, has been the origins of the investigation. And of course, nobody in that sort of fever swamp mentality even pauses to listen because they are so convinced that the Steele dossier is the sort of origin story of the investigation. And here Mueller, in the first couple pages of the report, says, by the way, here's how the investigation got started. And of course, it has nothing to do with Chris Steele. It has nothing to do even with Carter Page. It has to do with exactly the story that the FBI has been telling to anyone who will listen for a long time now.
I want to talk about Rudy Giuliani in a moment, but we have to just go back a little bit to talk about Bill Barr and the way that he summarized it. You walk through what the attorney general said, his partial quotations, the way he really distorted with the Mueller report. For example, he wrote, the special counsel's investigation did not find the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with Russia in its attempt to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And then it quotes very selectively, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government. And you point out, here's what Mueller actually wrote. The investigation also identified numerous links between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. Although the investigation established the Russian government perceived it would benefit from a Trump presidency and worked to secure that outcome, and that the campaign expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts, the investigation did not establish that members of the campaign conspired or coordinated. So give me your read. You know, after several days, all of this has, you know, we've gotten more of a perspective. Your take on what William Barr did and why he chose to do it.
So I try never to talk about people's motives. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to break that rule here. But what I will say is that Bill Barr's conduct was completely indefensible. And I think both in the letter And particularly in the press conference, mm-hmm. he, without saying any sentence that is not factually defensible in some literal sense, managed to completely miscommunicate major aspects of the substance of what Bob Mueller had done, said, and argued, and managed to do it in a fashion that was consonant with the talking points that the president and the White House are trying to advance. And that is wholly unbecoming the office of the Attorney General. And it is should have been beneath him personally. And the more deeply you read in this document, the less defensible his account of it becomes. And I, you know, honestly don't know. I don't know what he thought he was doing.
Yeah,
but I do think, and I assume you saw Charlie Savage's in the New York Times.
Yeah,
you know, pulled all of the incidents in which he had quoted the Mueller report, and then showed them all in context. And I don't know how Bill Barr is not deeply, deeply embarrassed by that. I mean, it's the closest thing I have seen to an attorney general flat out lying about the institutional work product of his department. And I say this as somebody who, as you know, has never, I haven't been looking to define Bill Barr as the enemy. I kind of made a point of giving him the benefit of the doubt on the redaction process that he undertook with respect to the document, on which I actually think he did a relatively decent job, although I have some questions. Yeah. And so I'm not somebody who started with a, you know, assumption that Bill Barr is a bad guy and a shill for Donald Trump. I'm quite appalled by the substance of the representations that he made relative to the actual text of the document.
All right. Now, because I'm a professional cynic, though, I'm going to take a step back and go, yes, whatever his motives were, though, his tactic is succeeding or has succeeded, at least in their own terms, because they have established this narrative, which virtually the entire Republican Party and right seems to have embraced, that no collusion, no obstruction. The president was exonerated. There's nothing to see. Let's move on here. You have Rudy Giuliani on yesterday morning, essentially, you know, once again, you know, claiming exoneration. In fact, let me play a little bit of a clip where Chris Wallace on Fox News has a clip of the president claiming that he was completely exonerated, and then Chris Wallace pointing out, no, it's not true.
You had said that if you were going to release the counter report, it was going to focus on obstruction. Here's what the president had to say about that after the Mueller report was released.
Right. They're having a good day. I'm having a good day, too. It was called no collusion, no obstruction.
But, Mayor, that's not true. The Mueller report makes it clear, especially on the issue of collusion, that
obstruction, that
he's leaving it to Congress. And I want to pick up on the report. Volume 2, page 8.
I agree with that. Okay. I agree that
Mueller... Well, good. Let me put this out here first. The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law. So Mueller invites Congress to look into this, and the president, in terms of Congress, hasn't been exonerated at all on the issue of obstruction.
So this is part of the problem, isn't it? You know, Ben, that we have this alternative reality, as you point out in your diary, that people will see what they want to see. And all of this evidence, which I agree with you, I think it's overwhelming. I think it's devastating. I think Congress, you know, has a constitutional obligation to deal with this. Otherwise, it normalizes it. And yet for a huge part of the American public, who the 99% that aren't going to read this report, this spin that Bill Barr became very much a part of is, okay, it's over, it's done, there's nothing to see. How do you counter, and I've made this argument before in other places, simple tends to trump complicated. How do you counter this kind of, and I'm sorry, just, you know, flat out hackery in the modern media information universe?
So I'm afraid I'm the wrong person to ask that question to, because I'm the guy who responds to the Mueller report by reading it line by line and writing a reading diary. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm the guy who's doubling down on complexity. And I don't, you know, I'm not a messaging person, and I'm not a, you know, notwithstanding my occasional flirtations with small pieces of artillery, I don't really do the simple. Yeah. Right. And you know, other than saying that I completely accept that you are presenting a very valid question, I have no idea what the answer to it is.
So
and let me give you an extreme example. So, you know, Lawfare, we're really proud of how many people read Lawfare. And, you know, that Lawfare is a kind of important voice in this conversation. And I'm really proud of everything we've done. I'm also keenly aware that the number of people who read Lawfare is a rounding error on the number of people who, you know, read Breitbart, right? And, you know, that simple and demagogic trumps complicated all the time.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you. And other than to say, like, but I also think I'm the most ridiculous person to answer that question, because I'm the guy who runs Lawfare, for crying out loud.
Well, I mean, the practical implication, of course, is that if you're Democrats in Congress, or Republicans in Congress as well, for that matter, what do you do with all of this? Well, you know, you're confronted with this massive evidence. I was actually on one of the MSNBC shows yesterday, and I was making the case that that what Congress needs to do is they need to build the case, particularly with the public, before dropping the hammer of impeachment. And the host, of course, was saying, well, we've been building that case for 3 years. Why do we need to keep doing this? I mean, Malcolm Nance has been making this point. And I tried to push back and say, yes, but not everyone in the world watches MSNBC. Not everybody is reading these stories. You're talking about Lawfare's audience. I mean, you know, not everybody reads the New York Times or the Washington Post or has been covering this. So this is a real dilemma, I think, for Congress, because you have both the political problem and you have the constitutional problem. The politics is complex because, let's face it, the public does not support all of this necessarily, which is why you have some division. And yet the constitutional obligation seems to me clear. And I agree with your colleague, Susan Hennessy, who says, look, you know, not moving ahead with impeachment is as consequential as moving ahead with impeachment. Because if you don't move ahead with impeachment, you're essentially saying that you are willing to tolerate this kind of behavior. You're normalizing this kind of behavior, and it's an abdication of responsibility. So I guess my take was that what's going to have to happen, and I hope I get the sense the Democrats understand this, they're going to have to educate the public. They have this great opportunity with these televised hearings to walk the public through all of this, the public that's not doing what you are doing and what I'm doing, which is reading this thing page by page. But there's going to be something riveting watching Bob Mueller on national television or Don McGahn on national television. And I don't think that people ought to fall into the assumption that this will not come as news to a large portion of the public.
I totally agree with you. I think there are a few important additional elements. So one is, remember that the riveting nature of such testimony will be diminished by the inability of members to ask coherent questions.
Yeah, they're not very good at it.
They're not very good at it, and they are very committed to this crazy 5-minute rule in which they all get a chance to make a speech for 5 minutes and then say, don't you agree, at the end of it to the witness and elicit no information. And so I do think the process that you're describing would work a lot better if the committees could come to, or at least if the Judiciary Committee could come to a more reasonable understanding of how it was going to allocate question time. And frankly, if it did some training of members about how to ask questions and develop lines of questioning, this is matters that a matter that, you know, any well-trained lawyer or frankly, any well-trained journalist is better at than 90% of members of Congress. The second key point, and I agree with you that the alternative universe problem is an immense one here. Look, you and I aren't allowed to do this because we're both under contract to MSNBC. But I actually thought it was, you know, an interesting thing that in a different context that Bernie Sanders went and did a town hall on Fox. And I do think interrupting that ecosystem with a, you know, with the non-alternative factual universe would be a constructive project for, you know, a certain group of people to do and to go on there and talk in a serious, sustained way about what this report actually says about presidential conduct. And to his credit, I thought Chris Wallace did a fairly respectable job yesterday, more than respectable, in interviewing Giuliani on the subject.
Oh, I thought so as well. And then one of my points that I tried to make on MSNBC, and of course they were like, no, we have to do it right now. We have to do it right now. I was like, well, wait, no, you know, you really do need to bring people along. And you don't need to flip half the Fox audience. You know, if Donald Trump's approval rating drops by only 2 or 3 points, that's going to make a world of difference on his prospects for reelection. You know, so I understand there's a kind of a nothing matters cynicism that's built in that nothing will move the needle. I'm not sure that people have thought that through, because I also think that the failure of Congress to very aggressively hold hearings, and whether it results in impeachment or not, I'm somewhat agnostic. I have a piece basically with my headline on the Bulwark is, should Congress impeach Trump? Definitely, maybe. And my point is that, yeah, maybe you will eventually get to all of that, but we're not at eventually yet right now. But the failure to hold those hearings to push this will in some ways send that message that what Donald Trump did was not that bad, that he's that in some ways not just normalizes it, but accepts the narrative that his character is not central to the 2016 election. So, but I also understand the incredible pressure from the resistance base to move ahead, but also the very principled argument that your colleagues have made that, look, if Congress is presented with evidence that the President of the United States has, engaged in corrupt, conduct, given the Department of Justice standard that he can't be charged with a crime, if Congress does not take it up, then literally he is above the law. I mean, we are at a moment here where and Mueller, I think, lays this out, that if Congress does not act, there is no recourse for the American public or the constitutional system to hold a corrupt criminal president accountable.
I think that's exactly right. Look, so a couple thoughts. Number one, people complain all the time about congressional powers atrophying and sort of, you know, migrating to the executive branch through a function of, to some degree, executive usurpation, but to a greater degree, congressional, you know, mis or non-use, right? So the classic example of this is in war powers, where, you know, it used to be that Congress had to decide whether we go to war, and now the executive branch decides whether we go to war. This is an example of this happening in real time. And if you look at this conduct and you say Congress might not even consider it under its impeachment authorities, don't even talk yet about whether they should impeach him. Let's talk about whether there should be a formal inquiry, right, as to whether they should impeach him. If you look at this report and think, oh, maybe we shouldn't have an impeachment inquiry because it would be politically inconvenient, what you're really saying is, I'm content to have the impeachment authority kind of atrophy, yes, and wither on the vine.
Right.
And don't complain then later when you find out my God, the congressional impeachment power has kind of gone the way of the congressional power to declare war. So I fully agree with you and with Quinta and Susan on that. There is a second question that I think is the other side of the seesaw that you're describing here, which is if you do it badly,
yes,
it could be catastrophic. And so you have a kind of fear of doing it well, a fear of not doing it at all, and concurrent fear of not doing it well. And I think the answer to that problem, there's only one possible answer that seems to me both principled and sensible, which is to do it very deliberatively and in a step-by-step fashion, making sure that you don't go beyond what the evidence says, that you're very rooted in things you can defend. Do it in a fashion that is minimally rhetorical and maximally based on a strong factual record, and do everything you are humanly capable of doing, of bringing as many people along with you as you can. Now, is that going to be, as you describe it, half of the Fox News viewing audience? Absolutely not. No. But if you could bring along an additional 5% of the electorate,
exactly,
that is a dramatically better outcome than if you can't.
Yeah, and I think that one of the keys is that building the case before impeachment. Once the word impeach, sort of like once you pull the dagger, you brandish the dagger, the dynamic changes. People, there's backlash. People get their backs up. People go back into their corners. And let's face it, I was reading this morning. I was reading the Lawrence Tribe Joshua Metz book on to end a presidency, which I think might surprise people in how sort of cautious it is. And it says, look, this impeachment might inflict an enduring national trauma. This could damage democracy for generations if it is done poorly. So there's lots of reasons to be prudent, to do it step by step, as you mentioned. And there's really only one really good example in American history of presidential impeachments that was done this way, which, of course, was the Nixon impeachment, which was bipartisan. Peter Rodino, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, went out of his way to involve the Southern Democrats and Republicans in that process, in rather dramatic contrast to the hyper partisan style of the Clinton impeachment. And to a certain extent, though, it did occur to me that the real trauma of an impeachment of the president is the prospect of undoing an election or removing a president. There's no prospect that Republicans will allow Donald Trump to be removed. So there's no chance that we are talking about the removal of the president. So in some ways, you could argue then there's no point in doing it. But the flip side of that is you've also lowered the stakes. So that what you are doing is the entire process is educational. You're going through, maybe it'll be accused of being a show trial, but maybe sometimes show trials are what we need. Do you follow what I'm saying here? Is that it lowers the temperature. You go through, you certainly have a dramatic drawing of a line, but you know that it's not going to result in the actual removal of the president of the United States. So that argument's going to play on both sides here.
Yeah. So I don't know that I disagree with any of that. I would put it a little bit differently. For me, the principal issue is a kind of retroactive analysis that you should imagine yourself as a congressman in 2021. So after the next presidential election and inauguration. Imagine yourself in two situations. One is the situation in which Trump has both involved Trump having been reelected. One involves the situation in which before his reelection, the House voted to impeach him and sent it to the Senate for trial. And the second situation is the one in which he was reelected and you did not, as the House, vote to have to send his impeachment to the Senate. And I worry if I'm in that former situation and I'm a member of Congress, I get to say at least the House of Representatives took the position in a formal way that this conduct was unacceptable in a president. You know, okay, the Senate disagreed with us. Okay, ultimately, the people in the United States disagreed with us, but there is an institutional position of this body that when a president engages with law enforcement in that fashion, he should not remain in office. That is one way of making sure that the conduct is designated in a lasting and formal way as unacceptable. Mm-hmm. I'm much more concerned about unacceptable than I am about illegal, by the way. Conversely, imagine now that there is not an impeachment proceeding and Donald Trump gets reelected. There are only two ways that we designate presidential behavior as unacceptable. One of them is by removing the person from office through electoral mechanisms. That is the best one. The other is by impeaching the person. And so now it is 2021, and neither of those mechanisms has designated this behavior as unacceptable. It seems to me that actually constitutes a ratification of the legitimacy, not just a normalization, but I did this. I, Donald Trump, did this stuff. Mueller documented it. The House decided to ignore it, and the people reelected me. That is a ratification, and that strikes me as the worst of all possible worlds.
Yeah, I agree. So what would you recommend that they – would they recommend – would you be satisfied with a censure or with a – and I'm making this part up – a formal finding by the House of Representatives that the president engaged in obstruction of justice? In other words, outcomes that do not involve actual formal impeachment?
Yes, I would be – well – I mean, if I were a member of the House of Representatives and there were articles of impeachment that were rooted in this factual record, I would vote to pass them. So that would be my view of my own obligation under my own oath. That said, my fundamental bottom line is every member of the House of Representatives has to go take a vote and explain that vote.
Yeah.
And if Republicans want to say, hey, it's fine for all of the president to have behaved this way because he's angry, he was angry, and by the way, it's really all about Chris Steele, okay, I accept that they will say that. And if Democrats, a lot of Democrats want to say, you know, I think this behavior is appalling, but I really don't want to do what Republicans did in the late 1990s, and I don't want to face the political consequences for this, so I'm willing to give him a pass. I would not necessarily admire that, but my fundamental bottom line is everybody should have to explain their position. And the only way I know how to do that is a formal process of considering the matter.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's also, I mean, other things they can do. They can pass legislation that deals with the integrity of the ballot box or clarifies things like, for example, the obligation of individuals or campaigns to report to the FBI foreign approaches. They could have a series of reforms that maybe Mitch McConnell will block them in the Senate. But as you say, at least it will get everybody on record going into the 2020 election that they, in fact, have absorbed that aspect of the Mueller report, which unfortunately, I think, tends to get lost here, which was the overwhelming evidence that the Russians not only attacked our elections, but are going to continue to do it. So the question is, what do we do about that? Benjamin Wittes, thank you so much for all of your time today. I appreciate it. And you can read all of these notes on the Mueller report over at the Lawfare blog, the Reading Diary, which I have found to be incredibly insightful and incredibly valuable in dealing with incredibly complicated but also a consequential report that we're all still trying to figure out what to do with. So again,
thank
you so much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.